Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us. We're about to have another conversation with Edward Wyckoff Williams, author, columnist, now working Al Jazeera on camera, doing a whole lot of stuff. And Edward Wyckoff Williams, welcome. Good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be back with you, Mark.
How are you?
Very good, buddy. Very, very good.
Good. Well, look, let me just start. Were you at the march yesterday? I mean, Saturday?
I was coordinating with people in Washington, but I actually had to be on television out of New York.
Okay.
So, so I was deeply involved in managing Al Jazeera booking Martin Luther King III, which was quite hectic, but he managed to do it, which is quite nice. He was basically, the entire King family was basically mobbed by the crowd, which I think security services should have recognized would happen. But they didn't necessarily plan for it correctly.
I think not as well. We were there all day long.
Yeah,
I texted you hoping we would be there and say hello, but they obviously were in New York.
So
talk a bit about your analysis of what that yesterday, your conversations with Bernice King, and your analysis of what you think that march meant yesterday.
It was so powerful because I think it was a moment of reflection for so many. Yes, we have come so far, and I think that a lot of the people on the stage, a lot of the speakers wanted to acknowledge how far we've come. And I think it was important for Attorney General Eric Holder to be there as a representative of Barack Obama, but also just sort of representing himself and what it means to have a black attorney general, right? Particularly when we're talking about civil rights that were legally denied African Americans in this country. And so the 50 years has shown tremendous progress. But I think that the entire event was basically in the shadow of the Zimmerman verdict and the Trayvon Martin tragedy. And the fact that the first march on Washington, and this is a little known fact, I think, in history, really, is that the first march, they chose the date August 28th, specifically because it was the date that Emmett Till had been murdered. And I think that the fact that 50 years later we now have, by proxy, another Emmett Till situation with Trayvon cast a shadow of doubt. I also think that the situation that President Obama has dealt with in terms of the kind of obstinance which reeks of white redemption era type style politics, that has basically been a sort of like, you know, the proverbial thorn in this president's side, also put a dampening, I think, on the event. But the people are so resilient, and it seems as though, particularly with a multicultural, multifaceted, multiracial coalition that was represented there, it shows that the best of America still exists, and people still believe, they're willing to fight, they're willing to organize, and that is so inspiring.
Yeah, and it felt that way on Saturday. I mean, there were so many, we witnessed families with their children. Clearly people wanted to have their children be part of that. We saw people from all over the country that we met from South Carolina and from Chicago and Toledo, and who came in droves from other places. One of the scenes I kept seeing over and over again were older people walking and marching with their hands on the shoulders of their children to keep them up as they were walking.
Mm-hmm. There was something so wonderful about all of that, and even hearing the stories about the busloads of Dream Defenders, those young people.
Yes, from Florida.
Who came from Florida, took buses from Florida, Washington, and I spoke to the young man who founded the Million Hoodie March, who I think you guys definitely need to have on air, actually, who organized for free buses to come from Harlem and Brooklyn. That is the kind of energy that we saw back in 1963, you know, and we didn't have the technology back then. They weren't on cell phones and Twitter and Facebook, and yet they came in droves, and I think over 250,000 people came back in 1963, and they're thinking that around the same number came this time, and I think that is just so inspiring. And I talked to, as you know, I talked to Dr. Bernice King, MLK's youngest child,
right,
about what this means for the next generation. And she basically, one of the things that I thought was so powerful is that she talked a lot about how I think oftentimes we become complacent. We need to maintain the momentum. We shouldn't stop after moments like the crisis around Trayvon Martin. We need to figure out a way to galvanize young people. But she said one of the things she thinks is important for people to understand is that the struggle is a never-ending process, and that freedom is never really won. You earn it and win it in every generation. I thought that that was so powerful because I had asked her, do you feel like despite how far we've come and yet the challenges we have, will we still need a civil rights movement in 50 more years or 100 more years? Will we still need to march? And she said emphatically, yes, of course we will, because there will be new issues. There will be new barriers. There will be new marginalized people. And it might not be African-Americans. It might not be Hispanics. But there will always be others, and we need to all stay engaged. And I think it's that kind of fervor and that kind of commitment which really brings about change. And I think that that's what you saw in the mall yesterday.
No, I think you did see that. Folks, join us here. If you were there on Saturday, we'd love to hear your thoughts on what you saw, what you felt at that moment. 410-319-8888. One of the people at the march that we saw there, if I say his name incorrectly, you'll correct me, Edward DiBiase, who is running for mayor of New York.
Oh, Bill de Blasio.
Bill de Blasio, who you interviewed
a week ago. Yeah.
And
he basically is you, for all intents and purposes. I mean, this is a white guy who's blacker than any black person I've ever met, you know? So I think, like, Bill de Blasio, I cannot wait for him to become mayor.
Do you think he's going to win?
I think he's going to win. I think Christine Quinn's going to give him a good run for his money, but... it's a part of why, did you notice what happened last week? And I know we're a bit off topic.
No, go ahead. It's okay.
A part of what happened last week is that Christine Quinn, who is the speaker of the New York Council, so basically like the speaker of the House, right?
Right, right.
She finally brought up for a vote whether or not they would veto Mike Bloomberg's whether they would overturn the veto of Mike Bloomberg stopping the bill to overturn Stop and Frisk. She finally brought that up. Now, what was interesting is that when I interviewed him, after the first debate and they had had the polls completely changed and he was leading, particularly after they showed his family and black people and Hispanics in New York realized that he was married to a black woman and had black kids, and he was talking about Stop and Frisk and how that might affect his 15-year-old son. After that, and he started leading in the polls, he said to me in that interview that she had been blocking that vote and that people needed to understand that she was basically acting as an agent of Bloomberg on the council. And when she saw that she lost her lead in the polls, she immediately brought that up for a vote. So she's hoping that she's going to get some momentum back. She's going to get those numbers back. And the black people and Hispanics in the city are going to say, oh, well, yeah, we'll give her credit for that. But that was actually not anything that she was intentionally going to do.
I mean, this race, and you've been covering it, covered Stop and Frisk in some of your pieces, and I thought that this has become, just like Trayvon Martin's death became a focal point.
Yeah.
And has become a focal point. This Stop and Frisk is a focal point that is picked up by the nation.
And you know why? Because by institutionalizing things like Stop and Frisk, in a place like New York, which basically serves as a model for the rest of the world in terms of its policing practices, it creates an environment in which an armed guard or armed neighborhood watchman like George Zimmerman can act out his own police-type fantasies, which is essentially to stop, frisk, kill a young black boy who just happens to be walking home from the store. And that's what happens in New York. People didn't understand that, you know, I did interviews and I did stories where 12 and 13-year-old kids, you know, in middle school, walking home with their book bags would be stopped, frisked, put up against the wall, put on the ground in New York City just because they were black boys. And there was a story, I think, that WNYC did, of a black boy who literally had gone to get ketchup, another who had gone to McDonald's, stopped, frisked, harassed by police. It had become so endemic. So then when you end up with a Trayvon, thank God for – it's sad, obviously, but thank God that story took on such momentum. It basically showed what happens every day.
And it literally every day. I mean, what do you think this council vote will mean in New York City?
What
do you think this council vote will mean? This overriding.
Well, yeah, they overrid it, and they've actually a part of it is that they've appointed some sort of federal oversight. Now, what's interesting about that is the case where the federal judge actually ruled it unconstitutional. She also appointed an inspector general of some sort to oversee
right.
the New York Police Department. But what was interesting about that is that that was going for appeal. Remember, so Mike Bloomberg and Ray Kelly stood in front of the world the day of that verdict and said that they would appeal it, and they did so a couple of days later. And with that appeal, that could have taken years before we have seen a resolution on that, right? Because it was going through the federal court system and could have even ended up at the Supreme Court. Whereas with this, now it ends it all because now the city council has spoken. I think stop and frisk right from this moment is illegal in New York City now. And also that the people who are affected by it have more ability to sue or on the basis of discrimination. So now they can actually sue these police officers. That's a really key thing because now police officers will think twice before they target young black males and young Hispanic males. And they'll actually have to be more strategic about looking for criminals. And that requires them to go back to community policing, which is actually what saw the reduction in crime to begin with.
Were you shocked at that vote?
I wasn't because Christine Quinn is as I'm getting more involved in interviewing politicians,
right?
Because you've seen the trajectory of my life over the last couple of years. You know, started off sort of just like standing on the outside looking in, and now I'm like in the mix of it all. But as I'm getting to know these people, I'm realizing that they're all political animals, and you know, I was extremely supportive of her because you know, as an African American who is also gay, I really did like the idea of the first lesbian mayor of New York.
Right,
but
right.
I think on this particular issue, she showed me that, and I hate to say this so blatantly, but that she showed me she's far more of a white woman than she is a lesbian. And I think there's something problematic about that. I think that the fact that she was so boldly in support of the Bloomberg policy and didn't see what was wrong with it shows that she benefits from a certain kind of privilege that makes her blind to the kind of discrimination that other people in that city must deal with every day. And that's not the kind of leader I want. I do want somebody broad-minded. I do want somebody open. I would love to see someone gay. But I would much rather have Bill de Blasio in that seat.
So in closing here, first of all, before we do close, I want to thank you for helping us arrange Tracy Martin to join us along with Ben Crump in the next part of our program. That means a great deal. But
make sure we get them on the line because I don't want anybody sleeping.
That's right.
Tell Mark to make sure everybody's lined up real quick before I get off the phone.
That's right. We don't need dead air.
Because you know me. And I will call them real quick and be like, Negro, where are you? Anyway, I've already said Crump Attack, so he's ready to go.
All right, cool. So tell us, I'm really curious of your kind of assessment of Dr. Bernice King after you interviewed her.
Wow. You know, I have to say, I was so humbled by the fact that I even got to talk to them. And they have done a great job of continuing not just Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream and his legacy, but also the legacy of Coretta Scott King. Because as I spoke to Bernice, there was so much of her mother, or at least what I perceived of her mother through all the videos and interviews that I've seen of her over the course of my life. There was so much richness there. There was so much commitment to the cause that is so deep. It's almost in their blood. And I have to say, I recognized after I spoke to her why they are king. They literally lead people to their better angels, and they transcend race. They even transcend time. These are the kind of spiritual and moral leaders we need in our society, and I'm so glad that we still have them, and I'm so glad that they're still about the work. They are doing God's work, and I'm just so grateful that I got to speak to her.
Well, I'm glad you did, too. It was an incredible piece. We're going to be linking to all this on our website at steinershow.org, the last several pieces that Edward Wyckoff Williams has been working on. You can follow his work through our website, also on The Root and many other places. Edward Wyckoff Williams, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, brother. Thank you so much for being
here. Always a pleasure to be with you, buddy, and I'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
God bless.
Bye-bye. We can take a very brief break, and when we come back, we are joined by Tracy Martin, father of Trayvon Martin and Benjamin Crump, the family attorney from the Tallahassee firm of Parks and Crump. Stay with us. We'll be right back.